On a cold and rainy Southern California Sunday, Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Welcome to the show, my friend. So glad you joined me, and I'm looking forward to talking with you over the next 2 hours about the critical issues of life, that being ethics, values, and religion. More critical now than ever, it seems. Lines open 1-800-227-5278. However, the lines are open for a special purpose here for this first hour, or at least portion of the hour. One of my favorite people in this business actually happens to have worked for us for about the last 7 years or so, and he's facing some big changes in his professional life that have something to do with Stand to Reason, and so we thought we'd talk about that together. Of course, that favorite person, Scott Klusendorf, for many years now, Director of Bioethics at STR, and arguably the best debater in the country on the pro-life issue. People won't debate him anymore. He's so good. Arguably the best trainer on the pro-life issue in the country, and we have had the privilege of working with him for quite a number of years now. Scott, it's great to have you on board today.
Greg, good to be back with you.
I mentioned that there's some changes in the wind here. Of course, there are things that we've been aware of for a long time at STR, and I'm thinking about how many years ago was it that you came on board with us?
I came on board in 1997. I believe officially my first day of work was October 1st, I think.
So you're just completing 7 years then.
Yeah.
Just finished 7 years. And I remember when you came on board with us those 7 years ago, you had called a couple of months earlier. We had made contact. You called us, Melinda and I, and said, you introduced yourself, and we met for lunch there in Westchester, or maybe it was breakfast, whatever. And I remember you saying, you know, I just want you to know who I am and make myself available to you with the skills that I have, such as I have, and I just want, because we're kind of fighting the same fight, and we should be on board a little bit together. And that was great. We knew, Melinda and I, that we were talking immediately. We knew that we were talking with someone of kindred spirit. I mean, just exactly Stand to Reason kind of material that morning, and really had one heart with us. And then a couple months later, you called us and said, how do I start my own organization, because I want to spend more time speaking and having an impact and for the pro-life cause. And we said, well, don't start your own organization then. To do that, why don't you find some organization that can give you the freedom to do what you do best? And that's when we asked you to come on board, and that was 7 years ago. And we have had a great, profitable 7 years of experience together, Scott. And I hope it's been the same for you.
Let me tell you, it was one of the top three best moves I've made in life. Number one being a commitment to Christ, of course.
Right.
Number two, marrying
Stephanie.
My wife.
Yes.
And number three, getting the excellent mentoring and partnership that I've enjoyed with STR for the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
I look back on that lunch we had in Westchester, and I view that, Greg, as a divine appointment. You know, I can't say at the time that I knew it was.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say God led me there.
Right.
At the time, I didn't know he was leading me there. But in hindsight, looking back.
And that's the way it usually works, it seems, huh? We can
see
God's hand that
you look
way.
Back and you say, you know, that was providential. There was something going on there. And I just remember you mentioned you felt that there was a kindred spirit there. Well, I felt the same thing. But the funny thing was, at the time, I didn't dream for a moment I'd be working with STR.
Mm-hmm. I remember something in that conversation, though, and that was that you were telling us what you did, and I was thinking, well, you know, we've got a couple of things with handles on them that we've used regarding the pro-life issue, and one of them was Daddy, Can I Kill This? That illustration. I remember suggesting it to you. You said, well, I've been using that for a while already. I've already incorporated that into the program here, so it was great to see that. And not only did we know we had a kindred spirit in terms of your concern for the unborn and the way you approach that issue, but just in terms of your personality, your love for the Lord, and you know, there's, for great relationships, it seems like there's got to be more than a lot of things penciling out. There's got to be a certain kind of chemistry, an intangible that you just know is there. And that was when Melinda and I walked away from that meeting, we said, boy, Scott's one of us. And we looked forward at that time to more involvement with you, never knowing that we'd have 7 years of close involvement as you made a singular contribution to Stand to Reason. Now, the reason we're revisiting history here is because this year has marked a change in our relationship, which will really be kind of completed the change, the transition, starting January 1, and this is why we wanted to have you on board to talk a little bit about some of the changes that were taking place in your life and some of the new directions that you felt it was necessary to go to have the greatest impact for the thing that you care most about in ministry, and that is ending abortion. Why don't you tell us about the genesis of that?
Well, about a year ago, you and I talked on the phone, and I mentioned to you at that time that I had a burning desire to launch a new pro-life effort that would be more ecumenical in nature and be less evangelical than what STR is in terms of its purpose. In other words, if you look at Stand to Reason today, you're going to see the finest Christian apologetics organization anywhere. And the goal of building Christian ambassadors who reflect certain values and certain character traits as they graciously engage the culture, you're not going to find that any better exemplified than at STR.
Thanks.
The problem I was coming up against had nothing to do with STR in terms of there being a fundamental flaw in its approach. My problem was that in order to build the kinds of coalitions we need in order to promote social justice on the pro-life issue, you have to pull people in from a much broader area. In other words, you've got to go out and do your best to bring in conservative Jews, bring in conservative Catholics, mainline Protestants, people who aren't necessarily committed to the same evangelical propositions we would hold.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, if your goal is to build Christian ambassadors who articulate key things, and your goal is to make that your primary purpose, what if you're dealing with people on a more narrow issue that requires kind of minimizing those things in order to focus on the broader social justice issue?
People you want to make common cause with
exactly.
On this other issue, the abortion issue, then you're looking for a much, you want to expand the tent, as it were, and because you're looking for a much larger group. I mean, even
exactly.
Not only Roman Catholics and those who are, in a sense, theologically near to us, but those even more distant, like Mormons or Jews, as you mentioned, who are conservative in nature, or even atheists for that matter, if on this issue
right.
They hold the same views, they are people that we should be looking to make common cause with on the pro-life concern.
Exactly, and I want to make it clear, I'm not in any way espousing religious pluralism
right.
here. I absolutely reject that. I believe that there is one true faith. I believe Christianity is the only way to salvation and that all other religions are false.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be any more clear on that. But when it comes to promoting social justice, you have to make common cause, as you said, with people who are theologically different than you.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was really funny. I was at lunch one day with somebody about a year and a half ago, and they were probing me on what my passion was. I said, well, and somehow in the conversation came up the idea of, well, you know, you do a lot of work with people who aren't evangelical. I said, you're right, I do. In fact, the majority of my work, if you want to get right down to it, is probably with Catholics. And this person said, well, what if they're not even Christian at all? What if they're not Catholic, evangelical? And my comment was, I said, look, I want to train pro-life advocates, and I don't give a rip what their theological
right.
views are. Now, I said that kind of, you know, just offhand, but it was conveying an essential passion I have to equip pro-life disciples, not evangelical ones.
Right, no, and this is a very important point to make, and you've made it really well. Incidentally, I mentioned that the phone lines would be open for
yeah.
certain type of calls. We want people to be able to call and talk to you, Scott. So let me just give the number, 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150, if you'd like to talk to Scott Klusendorf in the midst of a life transition here, organizationally, but certainly not with regards to mission, and if you've appreciated the work that he's done over the years, this is a good time to talk to him, because this will be our last public conversation as a member of Stand to Reason before Scott goes to the new organization, which we'll tell you about in just a moment. But of course, Scott will still be making common cause with Scott, and you'll hear him again in the future, but in a different context. I wanted to underscore this point you were just making, though. You don't give a rip what their theology is. I've made this point when I was speaking in other parts of the country on the pro-life issue. that I knew had theological squabbles amongst themselves on other issues, and they may be legitimate issues, and there's nothing wrong with having different points of view, but the theological squabbles were getting in the way of making common cause on this issue, saving the lives of unborn children. And I hearken back to, since I was in another state there, I was reflecting back on what was happening at the time in Southern California, and that is like three counties were ablaze, you know, and people see the pictures. Usually this time of year, we got early rains right now, which is good for us, but usually this time of year, there's fire everywhere. And I mentioned, you know, when people have their house on fire, and somebody comes along to help put the fire out, they don't ask what their theological view is on anything. All they want to know is whether they can carry a bucket.
Yeah.
And so we make common cause because the issue there is unrelated to theological distinctives. We want to put the fire out. And we've got a fire that's raging in our communities all over the country, and that fire is abortion. And in many cases, there's only one fire station in the community. That's that crisis pregnancy center. And it's important for us, as you've just pointed out, for us to put the theological differences aside that are unrelated to the task at hand that is putting out abortion's fire, and link arms and make common cause regardless of what their beliefs are. It doesn't, as you put it so well, that we don't give a rip about what their beliefs are. As long as they make common cause with, they're willing to make common cause with us on this, then we need their help.
And the beauty of that is, Greg, we don't have to concede any ground to religious pluralism to do that.
That's right.
And many a time I will work training pro-life advocates of a different religious persuasion than myself. And then at dinner that night, when we're done with the work we need to do, I'm more than willing to discuss theology. In fact, I'm one who likes to provoke those discussions.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you do so much work with Roman Catholic groups, I mean, it's a significant part, and we're thrilled that you're able to do that. And you're coming from a, let's face it, stand to reason, a Protestant group, which does take, in a low-profile kind of way, positions different from Roman Catholicism. And when the circumstances are appropriate and discussions come up where we stand against some of those beliefs and we make the distinctions known, this can be troublesome in a way for the work you are doing through Stand to Reason to the rest of the country.
It can be, but I want to point out something. I think those positions you take up that are maybe contrary to Roman Catholic theology need to be taken up. That's the purpose of Stand to Reason, to clarify Christian faith and to clarify what we believe theologically, morally, and in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that at times there will be things said by people who are of a different denomination than us, and we need to confront those things. But you are correct that it does become a stumbling block to some people, and in fact even some very influential people, who wonder then, well, where am I coming from? Am I just an evangelical spy that's infiltrating their ranks?
Corporate espionage there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And plus, if they're sending money to support your enterprise, and you do, you have raised your own support, and so people are your donors, but the money goes to Stand to Reason, and it might raise an eyebrow. And your enterprise now is to, after the 7 years with us and leaving behind a massive storehouse of information and goodwill and training and discipleship, and the members of our staff, et cetera, are striking out into a new endeavor. And tell us about the organization that you're starting that will focus specifically and explicitly on the life issue.
Well, we have begun a group called Life Training Institute. We being myself and Steve Weimer, who has done great work promoting my speaking events for really the last 6 years or so, but only in the last year or so as a paid employee.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are aiming to do, Greg, is to help pro-lifers articulate the convictions and beliefs they have, but they find themselves struggling to know how to do that in a secular culture.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, quoting Bible verses to people doesn't cut it. Not that we have a low view of Scripture, not that we think Scripture is not important, but we know that if you start with Scripture, start with theology, or if you're Catholic and start with church authority, you immediately shut down the debate with people who come from a very different worldview.
You're speaking a different language.
You are.
Might as well be speaking Swahili because they're not listening.
Exactly. So now the question becomes, how do we communicate the truth of the biblical worldview on issues like abortion but do so in a way that our secular critics cannot merely dismiss as religious.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, both sides of the abortion debate bring certain metaphysical assumptions to their view. They definitely have theological underpinnings, both sides, not just the pro-life side.
Right, that's right.
But that alone does not mean our position can only be defended by an appeal to religion, the way that a Ronald Dworkin would argue, or others who have argued that the pro-life position is inherently religious, therefore has no place in the public square.
Mm-hmm.
We challenge that. We don't believe that. We think we can give public reasons for what we believe, and we can do so in a way that our secular critics have to engage those reasons and tell us why our reasons are wrong.
Simply put, an atheist could hold your very same reasons with no theological baggage, no theological axe to grind, and so therefore, if one has to address the atheist's reasons, then they got to address yours just as well.
That's exactly right. And to just real quickly give you a flesh and blood example of this, about a month ago I spoke at the University of North Carolina Law School, and I gave an hour-long presentation there where I laid out public reasons in support of the pro-life view using science and philosophy. And these were secular law students. We were right there in the rotunda of the law school building at UNC.
Hmm.
And at the end of the talk, the first person to raise her hand was a woman in her late 30s, maybe early 40s. And she identified herself as a professor there in the law program. And she said, "I came to this talk today really thinking it would be a waste of time because I expected to hear a lot of emotion, a lot of religious sentiment." And she said, "Quite frankly, I'm astounded by what I heard here today. I don't know what to do with it." She said, your talk was so persuasive and so well laid out that I know there must be a flaw in your logic, but I'm at a loss to find where it is."
Yeah, Scott, you got to have mixed feelings about in a certain sense, and I want to come back after a break and suggest what I mean by that.
Yeah, I know what you're going at.
Okay.
I agree. Yes, I do have mixed.
we've got some callers on that want to congratulate you in this move forward, and we'll take those two in just a moment. Talking with Scott Klusendorf and the birthing of a new organization, Life Training Institute, as he moves on from his very productive and fruitful tenure at Stand to Reason to begin this new thing. And we'll be talking with him. If you want to call, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code 754-4150, of course you can talk to Scott and give him a piece of your mind about the move that he's making. And we'll pick up with that in just a few moments, and we'll tell you about some more things that are happening. We are not saying goodbye in ultimate sense to Scott by any stretch of the imagination, but we'll give you some more information on what's happening in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel. Stay with us here on Stand to Reason. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON. or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops listen.
Sweet music for our December, first broadcast of December here as we start out the Advent season. Now, this isn't a theological song, but I'm going to tell you, this does as much to put me in the spirit of Christmas as any song I know. And partly because, to me, Christmas spirit is a lot of how you were raised and what kind of stimulated that sense of specialness of Christmas. And that's it. Listen, I want to remind you that this being Christmas, Christmas is followed by January. January always is our month for the Master Series of Christian Thought here in Southern California. We have six different speakers starting in January, January 10, that I want to tell you about. It's a great lineup as usual. Dr. William Lane Craig kicks off, as he often does. He'll be talking about is one true religion possible? So the philosopher talking about the philosophic ramifications of religious pluralism. The week after that, January 17, mark this one, Hugh Hewitt, Emmy Award winner, former counsel to legal staff for Ronald Reagan, put together the Nixon Library, worked with Dick Nixon for many years, and now with a syndicated radio talk show host of his own, or rather talk show of his own. The topic in but not of, the title of his most recent book for Christians, How Christians Can Have Influence on the World. So Hugh Hewitt in person, and that'll be January 17th. The 24th, Dr. James White, The Authority of Scripture, Why We Can Trust This Book. January 31st, Dr. J.P. Moreland, he has just given a tremendous talk in San Antonio, I saw 2 weeks ago, on the issue of postmodernism, a refutation of it, and a challenge for those Christians who are toying with it, that it's a coward's way out. And he'll be reprising that talk on a more popular level January 31st, and then I'll anchor the series on February 7th, fresh back from my trip to New Zealand and Australia, and I'll be talking about the Bible and same-sex marriage and setting the record straight on that issue. So January 10th through February 7th, the Master Series of Christian Thought coming up. Hope Chapel is hosting that, as they've done for the last, 15 years with us, with me, and the last 11 years with Stand to Reason. And so please mark your calendars Monday nights from 7 until 9:30 or 10 o'clock, depending on how long the questions go. We're talking with Scott Klusendorf, of course, with us for 7 years as our Director of Bioethics, and now embarking on a new adventure called Life Training Institute, which will, in a sense, be formally kicked off January 1, although this last year, Scott, you've been involved for, putting this thing together and laying the foundation and really doing your de facto transition out of Stand to Reason. But you made a comment in our, as we were talking a few moments ago, and I wanted to respond to this, and we'll go to some calls. And that was that you had given this presentation at the university, and it was a law school, and the law school professor said she was stunned to hear such a lucid presentation of the pro-life view, and she frankly didn't expect anything this good. And of course, this is what you've been training people to do, Stand to Reason, for 7 years now. And the reason I have mixed feelings about that, and of course, I'm glad for you, and because I know you can do that. And I'm glad that she got a chance to hear that. That's the good news. The bad news, of course, is why is it that she's never heard a lucid explanation of this issue up until now?
Yeah, and Greg, you're hitting on a key point here. I think a lot of Christians are very uncomfortable engaging secular people. We either feel ill at ease because we think, boy, we got to make this spiritual. We have got to share the gospel. I'm thinking of a man who was supporting my work for many years, and when he heard that I was going to make a move away from being explicitly evangelical in my approach, he wrote me and said, well, I feel like you've just thrown Christ in the back seat of your outreach,
mm-hmm.
as if somehow I'm dishonoring Christ because I'm going to do my best to try to reach out to secular people and people from other religious persuasions that may not share my theological world.
Scott, you've never been an evangelist. It's not what you do.
Exactly.
It's not your role at Stand to Reason, even.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can be an evangelist as you know, opportunities present.
Of course, in your role as a Christian and a
right.
follower and disciple of Christ and an ambassador writ large there, but your particular professional role in ministry is something very particular skill that is geared to your particular skills.
Exactly. And so, but for some Christians, that's not good enough. It's like if you're not quoting Scripture or mm-hmm. not somehow linking it to saving that person's soul at that moment,
mm-hmm.
you're failing the cause of Christ. And I like to remind people of what you've often talked about, of dropping a pebble in someone's shoe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. As soon as someone concedes, as the result of hearing my presentation or yours, where we make a case for the pro-life view using public reason, once they concede that morals are real, then they've just opened the door
Absolutely.
To theism.
That's right.
Because if morals are real, then it follows there must be a moral lawgiver who
mm-hmm.
is real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, ergo theism. Now, that doesn't mean we've proved Christianity is true, but we have certainly ruled out atheism.
Sure, and we've moved a lot closer. This is a discovery that people make that certainly rules out naturalism and materialism, because the moral rules aren't natural and they aren't material. They aren't made out of that kind of stuff. And it opens a whole new world to them, and if they start thinking a little bit about the nature of this kind of thing, it's going to be very difficult to stay away from theism, because it's that worldview that makes best sense of this discovery of moral rules. In fact, Bernard Nathanson is a great example of a person who, as an atheist and a former founder of the National Abortion Rights Action League in New York, one of the largest abortion providers in the state of New York in the history of the abortion controversy, yet on the merits of the issue itself, reflecting with his God-given mind and the conscience that God had instilled in him, realized that abortion was taking the life of an innocent human child, and then became pro-life, after which he had a spiritual epiphany as he saw the logical consequences of his beliefs.
Yeah, exactly, Greg. And I think that we need to view these as opportunities to drop that pebble in someone's shoe.
Yeah.
And that's always how I've approached it. You gave me that nice little way to phrase it, and I'm grateful for that. But that's what was happening with this law professor at the University of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And she thanked me. And there she is in front of about 40 of her students, in
wow.
addition to the other, I don't know, 60 or so that were present. And what an amazing, amazing exchange.
Mm-hmm.
She asked some follow-up questions that were very good, and I had a chance to engage her on these issues. But this is the kind of thing that my heart beats to do, is
mm-hmm.
to go into those kinds of environments and train others to do it, not just do it all myself.
Right, work yourself out of a job.
Yeah, you know what? I long for that.
And you've been very effective at that, and so is some of our other trainers at Stand to Reason. We'll talk about that in a moment, who you're leaving in your wake to do the job at STR that you've been doing for the last 7 years. But I wish I had a dime for the time, for every single time somebody wrote us a letter, or called us on the phone, or talked to me on the air, or talked to me at an event and said, you know what, we took your material that you and Scott put together, Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion, or Pro-Life 101, or Pro-Life 102, or some of the other things that we have produced, Precious Unborn Human Persons, and I took that and I did a debate on this, and it was a pro-choice class and a pro-choice teacher, but the teacher said, not only did all the people think that I won the debate, in some cases the pro-choice debaters changed their mind,
yeah.
and the teachers consistently say, I have never heard anybody do anything as good as this, even though they're pro-choice.
Yeah. And that's what we want. We want to be the best we can be at doing our job, and we want to equip believers to reach out to that secular culture the way that Paul reached out to a very godless
mm-hmm.
culture in Athens when he, well, it wasn't a godless culture, but it was certainly not a Christian one.
Right.
He cited
yeah.
their own poets
right.
to make a case for the resurrection of Jesus
mm-hmm.
Christ. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here. We're not throwing aside our religious convictions. We are simply trying to make our case in a way and using language that people who aren't with us theologically can still relate to.
Right. Scott, let's go to some callers because people want to say hi. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's John Cookston.
Yes, John, great to hear from you.
I don't have the Ferrari 12-cylinder brains that either of you have, so I'm doing something that's very foolish for me operating on my two cylinders, which is trying to talk to you while I'm driving. But I'm impelled to offer my congratulations to you in every way I can think of, Scott. I'm prepared to say what Greg is uneasy saying, and you are definitely the best, no question. While I'm at it, I might as well congratulate you and Melinda and everybody on how many political victories you've gotten. Yeah, I mean, all the judges are being appointed, all the governors and all the presidents are doing what you want.
Well, John,
you're even getting them to call it a double murder when Scott Peterson.
Yeah, the reason I'm chuckling, John, and I'm sure you understand this, John Cookston's been a friend of Stand to Reason and mine for a long time, and John is very gracious and kind and affirming to myself and Scott and what we're doing, though he doesn't hold any of the views we hold hardly, and that's why I so much appreciate your kudos here, because we know you're setting up on the opposite side on this issue as with many others, but
well,
it's
I'm
great
not
to
setting you up for a 1-2 or anything. My congratulations.
No, I understand. Yeah.
I will.
I know they're sincere. That's the point I'm making, and why you might hear me and my listeners hear me chuckling in the background, because I'm so tickled by your sincere appreciation, even though I know your views are quite different than ours, and you're not happy with the way the election went.
No, but anyway, you guys are in Fat City, and I can rejoice with those who are rejoicing. I still remember a couple of Bible quotes.
Uh huh.
But now, you know, I might as well interject a question that ties in perfectly with what you've been discussing. And that is, I was just at a lecture, I guess it was 2 days ago, a fellow named Stephen Hunter, who's a true expert in paleontology, who listens and calls into your show regularly as an atheist, called in to say to you of David Wells, this guy is a Mooney who believes that some young moon is God. And wouldn't it be of more concern to you to see to it that he doesn't keep believing something that will send him to hell, or something that egregiously wrong from your point of view, than to get him up to snuff on Archaeopteryx?
Yeah, you don't mean David Wells, you mean Jonathan Wells of Icons of Evolution. David Wells is another very orthodox Christian writer. But yes, Jonathan Wells, part of the Discovery Institute, who wrote Icons of Evolution, who's been on this show before, we've had dinner with him, he does not share our theological beliefs. I actually have not had occasion to get into theological discussions with Jonathan Wells, but it is much more important that he get Jesus right than he get the fossil record right, and or the issue of intelligent design right. I agree with you there. Just like anything else, you take the opportunities that you're able to take. This is a case where we've made, and other Christians have made, common cause with somebody in his field, in their field, in an area that's important to us, much like Scott is doing here in LTI, but at the same time we have significant theological differences. This issue has never actually come up in any conversations I've had with Jonathan, but I've only been, you know, together with him in a one-on-one a handful of times. Usually we're just kind of passing each other at an event or something like that. But I think you're right.
It was of concern to this fellow. I mean, it prevented your witness from being as effective as might that you put this on the back burner. Even after he advised you of this. Now, in the case,
well, I knew Scott, that before. I didn't need to find out from this fellow about that. But in any given situation, you just got to make your judgments about the best use of your time.
Yeah, and I think
I understand.
I think I can add a little something here, too. By the way, John, thanks for your kind remarks. John has been at several of my lectures, most recently at Loyola Marymount University, and he's always a gracious critic, always asks questions rather than making statements, and if only all of our critics were as gracious. So
right.
Kudos to you for that, John.
Well, thank you so much for slopping back that mutual admiration.
Well, I don't want you to wreck your car, so I've got to make sure we make things really nice here.
And I'm so embarrassed I'm going to give all these millions of other people who want to congratulate you a chance before I crash here.
Yeah, we're gonna get to them in just a minute. Scott,
let me just say one thing about this.
Sure.
That's on a related note. Sometimes the pro-lifer will be asked, and I'm not sure John was getting at this directly. It was a little hard to hear his question, but I'll throw it out anyway. Sometimes a pro-life advocate will be asked, well, listen, babies dying is bad, but people going to hell is worse. So why are you spending more time on saving the child here and now than you are saving people from going to hell? And I do agree that in the long run, saving souls is the more important thing to do, but saving the child is the more urgent need of the moment. If, for example, let's say I knew my neighbor was going to take his son to the First Church of the False God next Sunday, where they will attend worship services and then return to eat lunch together, and I knew that my other neighbor was going to take his son to the woodshed and torture him for 2 hours and then kill him, I would make a choice to intervene first in the father that was going to harm his child.
Right.
And then intervene over time with the guy who's got bad theology.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that we're saying one is more important than the other. I think I don't want to set up a false dichotomy.
Right.
It is
the urgency issue.
Yeah, it's a matter of doing what's more urgent at the moment.
John, thanks so much for the call. It's great to hear from you again. Let's go to line two here. And Doug, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Hey, Greg, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I tried to call about a month ago. I tried to get through, couldn't get through. And now it got through, and perhaps it's providential. I was calling about a program that I saw, Faith Under Fire, Lee Strobel.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott Klusendorf, your guest, was on there debating, was it Peggy Noonan?
Peggy Lunan.
Lunan.
Oh, that's a different one. There is a Peggy Noonan who's a significant
conservative writer.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is Peggy Lunan.
She's with Life and Liberty for Women. Yeah.
I can see how that would be confusing. Did you have a response now in or a question in light of this clarification, or is that you just wanted to know about that, Doug?
No. I watched the program, enjoyed it very much, but there was one thing that kind of concerned me, and I wanted to make apply it. I'm just wondering if sometimes it's we seem to bend over backwards to appeal to a reason, and sometimes in doing so we have a tendency to neglect to bring the biblical evidence to the table, particularly when we're talking to other Christians, which this Peggy Lunan seemed to be. If I can take us back, she kept appealing. I think Scott's answers were just absolutely, for the most part, pretty devastating to most of the points she tried to take, but every time she would retreat into her corner, and she would always say that God is pro-choice. She would say that was her position, but she would always put it this way. She would say something like, I don't know why God is pro-choice, but in Exodus 21, it's obvious that God doesn't give the unborn equal status to the born. And I didn't hear, Scott give a what I thought was a... It was a reasonable answer, but it didn't seem to me like it addressed the Exodus 21.
Okay, let me put you on hold for a minute, Doug, and Scott also, because we have to go to break. And when we come back, we'll have Scott respond to that just a little bit, because there's a couple of things that could be said, some having to do with the text itself and other things that have to do with, just the tactics of a crossfire situation when you've got a whole debate you got to do in 14 minutes with commercials, that's a difficult situation itself. So hang on there. We'll be back with you both and Scott Klusendorf. Kind of late of Stand to Reason and new of Life Training Institute. We'll talk more about that transition when I return on Stand to Reason. How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise, it's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time of the year. I don't know if there'll be snow, but have a cup of cheer. Have a holly jolly Christmas.
Greg Kochel back with you now, giving you a piece of my mind with my good friend and colleague Scott Lusendorf, who's actually sat at this microphone in my stead many times in the past, and we look forward to when you're in town to doing that in the future, Scott. Scott, founding a new organization called Life Training Institute, and we've talked a little bit about that now. I know we're taking your calls of congratulations, encouragement, and question. And Doug, you've asked your questions there. Do you mind if I just let you take it on the radio now, and then we'll have Scott respond to it?
If I can just make a comment, and then you guys can respond.
Okay, quickly.
On that, I was kind of disappointed because she kept referring to the Exodus 21:22 verses 22 and 23.
Right.
And says that God says there that the unborn doesn't get the same status, legal status.
This is the case where men are fighting and there's a miscarriage, right. And if there's a miscarriage on one reading, then there's a fine, but if the mother is hurt or if she's killed, it's life for life, and so it seems to imply in first blush that the child, the fetus, doesn't have the same value,
right,
as mom does.
I don't know how she can use that, and I'm just wondering why that wasn't brought up as a pro-choice argument, because the verse clearly states that even if the child doesn't die, the person would be punished.
Yes.
That's 180 degrees away from a pro-choice. But,
right. Okay, Doug, thanks for the call, and we'll have Scott answer. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, Doug raises a fair question. You know, it's interesting. TV debates are almost always inadequate for getting across a full explanation of your position. Mm-hmm. The medium itself does not allow for detailed explanations. It only allows for sound bites. And the way it works on TV is, I don't care whether it's a Christian program or a secular one, what the producers want is fast-moving, rapid-fire, hot exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to decide then, what do you think your opponent will put forward as her primary argument, and you better be prepared to deal with that one. And when she brings up a secondary argument, you have to be prepared to deal with it quickly so that you can keep nailing her on the primary one. And that's the strategy I chose for this debate. Her primary argument was not Exodus 21. Her primary argument was that Scripture teaches that the unborn are not human and valuable until they breathe air through the nostrils.
Mm.
And I used a tactic that we teach at Stand to Reason called taking the roof off, where I pointed out that that passage cannot possibly be teaching that, because if it were true, it would not only justify abortion, it would justify infanticide, because babies, once they're born, do not immediately begin taking air through the nostrils. That does not happen, in some cases, up until 3 to 4 minutes after the birthing procedure is completed.
Now, is she working off of the passage from Genesis chapter 2 when Adam is created?
Yeah, a man and he became...
Yeah, and my one-liner on that is that kind of thing, that rule applies to all men made of mud.
Yeah.
And if you're not made of mud, you know that...
Exactly, and that's exactly
a different rule,
right.
Applies, right.
But I even went so far as to consult with a OB doctor prior to going on the show to make sure I had my facts straight, and mm-hmm. was assured that I did. And I called her on that, and she had a meltdown over that. She
mm-hmm.
did not know how to handle it, and it destroyed her credibility totally. So, yes, it's true. I did not have time to go into a detailed theological explanation on Exodus 21, and it does require a little bit of unpacking
right.
to explain that passage.
In fact, let me just suggest that people go to our website at str.org, and I've written a piece called What Does Exodus 21 Really Say? And I go into some detail there, and if I could just jump in quickly so we can get some other callers in, Scott. The tip there is, the key here is, the idea when it says the baby, and the literally in the Hebrew, comes out, there is no suggestion in the Hebrew that the baby comes out dead.
Right.
Although in the English translation, miscarriage, it does carry that notion. It's not in the original. It just said if you have a premature birth, and some of the better translations say this, and then it says, and then afterwards, if there is any further injury, then it's life for life.
Right.
So the injury there, presumably, is to either the child or the mother, and so the child in that passage is dealt with, if you're careful in the Hebrew, exactly like a valuable human being. And go to the website, str.org, What Exodus 21 Really Says, and there's the full breakdown, all the Hebrew, the
right.
entire analysis for anybody who'd like to check that out. Scott, let's go to Dave, because Dave would like to chat with you, too. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Thank you for everything you guys both do.
You're welcome.
And I actually thought of you guys this week. I was listening to an abortion argument on the radio, and it just seems like every year there's kind of a new, you know, abortion advocate argument that just seems, it's like the flavor of the month. It's just kind of
a new twist, huh?
Exactly. And it seems the new one I'm hearing a lot is, well, what are you going to do if you make abortion illegal? Are you going to put women in jail or the death penalty, or what are you going to do as far as punishment goes? And I was wondering what the best answer for that was.
Scott?
Well, you know, we heard the same thing about civil rights legislation in the 60s. You know, we were told that if we pass legislation like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, requiring that blacks receive equal treatment under the law, what are we going to do then to business owners who don't want to hire blacks? Are we going to throw them in jail? See, people deserve justice under the law, not because it's convenient or not because it meets with popular approval, but because it's demanded by the moral principle. And in this case, if the unborn are human beings, then it really clarifies the issue right away. In fact, even pro-abortion philosopher Marianne Warren makes this same point. She says, look, if the unborn are human, and we're worried about women being prosecuted for killing the unborn or doctors being prosecuted, that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if we're worried about women dying from illegal abortions, because murder is wrong regardless of the consequences of prohibiting it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got it right on that point. The central issue here is the status of the unborn. It's not what deleterious effects are going to fall upon society, because if people are subjects of rights, and we believe the unborn are, then they should be given those rights and not denied them simply because someone might be prosecuted. But secondarily, I will point out that oftentimes you'll hear, I've heard this in debates, where people will say, look, you know, you're going to end up sending women who have abortions directly to the gas chamber. Well, that's ridiculous. We don't do that with people who commit homicides today. You have differing degrees of penalty. There's circumstances that are always weighed in on the court. And so you don't have an automatic ticket to the gas chamber just because you do a capital crime or commit a murder. And the same would be true here with the abortion issue.
Dave, there is a piece that I wrote in response to a letter sent to us on this very issue. It's on our website at str.org. I can't remember the title to it, but there's a section on our website. If you look around there, it's
okay.
Called...
Probably under the abortion section.
Yeah. Well, if you type in abortion, you'll probably get it. But there is a section called Town Hall where people send in questions, and we've answered it, and we've posted them, and this very thing comes up. And the heart of my response is people are mystified. They act like, what are we going to do if we make this illegal? No one will know. Charging people with murder, oh, lions and tigers and bears, oh, my. The fact is that abortion was illegal for 200 years in the history of this country. It wasn't until 1972 that it was made legal, de facto legal, by the courts. And one-third of the states in this country, including the great state of California, have fetal homicide laws. That is, it's illegal and, in fact, homicide to kill an unborn child. And there is a whole system of prosecution that's in place when that happens. Of course, there are exceptions to those rules, and that if mom says so and a doctor does it, abortion on demand, then the law doesn't apply. But the law is already in place, Dave, and I would suggest people just go back to the way the laws are stated now. This is not a problem we have to solve. It's already been solved. So check out the website. Thanks for the call. You know, Scott, you're moving on to LTI, Life Training Institute, but you haven't left us as orphans here at Stand to Reason. Tell us about Steve Wagner.
Well, Steve joined our staff about 3 years ago, but he and I had lunch together. Boy, now I'm going to have to stretch my mind. I'm guessing it was back in 1991, maybe late 90, or not 91, I'm sorry, 2000, 2001. And he said to me, look, I would love to do the kind of work you're doing. And I've heard that before, and you know, you're always a little skeptical when you hear that. And so I gave him some things to do to kind of test to see if he was really interested. By golly, he did them. He read up on the subject. He mastered the logic of the pro-life view. And lo and behold, he, to make a long story short, left his teaching career, where he was a very successful high school music teacher, and joined our bioethics staff at Stand to Reason. And he has now built up quite a reputation as being a, I think, the best campus pro-life trainer you'll find anywhere in the country for pro-life students. This guy is a master at engaging people in live debate on college campuses. He trains the pro-life students on campus how to engage their secular critics. He's done fabulous work. Working alongside my colleague David Lee at Justice for All.
Right, and through Focus on the Family and their training institute there.
And he's now teaching at the Focus on the Family Institute, training their students how to engage correctly on campus.
Let me say something about this concept of mastery, though. You mentioned this, and I think people are probably tempted to think of somebody who, like Steve, who's mastered this, is somebody who knows all the answers. And, of course, what we're talking about is something that goes far beyond knowing the issues and knowing how to respond, because mastery is mastery in an ambassadorial sense. Knowledge, certainly, but also wisdom, tactically speaking, and character. This is a guy that knows how to maneuver exceptionally well, knows when to back off, knows when to speak strong and then speak soft, and he works over a period of time with the students that he's working with to actually teach them how to do this, and he's a master at it. And not only does he do the training, but he's doing public speaking events. I used to say to you, Scott, you know, wherever I'd follow you, you left a fragrance behind that was wonderful and appealing. And people are always talking about you, and now I'm finding the same thing with your charge, your disciple, the one you have groomed to take over after you at Stand to Reason, that now when I follow Steve, and he's been around, I hear people coming up to me and saying the same kind of things that they used to say about you.
Well, I appreciate that, Greg, and you know, it's funny because I heard indirectly that there was a Christian high school in Denver that I used to spend quite a bit of time at teaching and training their students, and now Steve has kind of taken that position over for me. And they're not that interested in having me back.
Well, what could be better? What a greater, you know, you must decrease and he must increase.
You know what? I'm fine with that. I absolutely think that's great. And interestingly enough, even with Life Training Institute, we're going to continue to promote Steve and your work with the larger pro-life community and dropping your names where we can. It's about building coalitions, and there's no way we're going to...
We're all in this together. And one reason I wanted to bring up Steve is to let people know that even though you're moving on, we still have a very vital commitment to the pro-life issue, and we have staff that are directly and full-time involved in the bioethical questions and the issues, debating and teaching and training and speaking and being available for fundraising events and the like. So we haven't changed there, but you have multiplied yourself, Scott. Tell us very quickly. Well, let's see. We got one more call, so let's go to this final caller. And Gretchen, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, just a couple quick points. I just wanted to thank you, Scott, and for giving us that great training resource in making an abortion unthinkable package. And we got that, and my husband and I, we were happy to have just a couple people at our house who were kind of disappointed, but as a direct result of the flyer that we created, There was one baby saved just straight up.
By the way, you mean you were disappointed that
we were disappointed
only because
there was only a couple people that came to our class.
I got you. You weren't disappointed in the material, right?
Yeah, we gave a flyer. My husband gave a flyer. A conversation ensued. There was abortion being discussed right there. A guy, you know, anyways, the story can go on, but it was a direct result of him getting this flyer.
Yeah, you know, I was in Fargo, North Dakota just a couple of weeks ago, and also in northern Minnesota as part of that same trip, and I talked to two different people who are working in the pro-life movement now that said that their minds were completely transformed and changed around by going through that material, making abortion unthinkable, the art of pro-life persuasion.
It's fabulous material. We love it. We hope to try and get that class going again in our home. The other thought that I had right when I heard you talking and thinking about the changes that you're making is that I was thinking, you know what, there's a lot of great evangelists out there, but how many people are there that are going to be doing what you're doing? Very few,
right.
As far as bridging the gap there between all the different denominations, Jew, and all of these different things. And our culture in America is just, you know, it's going to hell in a handbasket with this particular topic. And there are people of what you're planning on doing. Don't look back, because you are needed in what the changes that you are going to be making. And there's lots of evangelists out there that are evangelizing everyone around.
Good point, Scott.
It's willing. You know, you're stepping into for a place that it seems to be needed, and it seems like a no-brainer to me that you're making a great decision.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, Gretchen, thank you for your kind words. That means a lot to me. And, you know, just to reinforce what you said, I just got done reading a Weekly Standard article today on the decline of culture in the Netherlands, and how 100 years ago the Netherlands was the bastion of Reformed theology. I mean, you couldn't have picked a better place for Reformed theology to be prevalent. And look where it is today, the most decadent culture in the world. Mm. And the writer was making the point that although the people had the right theology, they disengaged the culture. And look what happened within just a few short generations. And so I do think that if we want to see the church influence in the culture, it does require us upholding truth as being a real thing. And one of the best issues to make that point is the pro-life issue.
Gretchen, thank you for the call. And Scott, just a minute to go here. And we have a minute. Is that right? No, we're almost out of here. Okay. I want to thank you for myself, for your great friendship over the years, Scott, and for the tremendous contribution you made to Stand to Reason, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Greg.
Great working with you, buddy.
You as well. Couldn't have been better.
Thanks a lot. Scott Klusendorf, moving on to Life Training Institute, an organization that he has started himself with some others and to focus more on his gifts and making a difference for the unborn. Great to have him on board, and we'll be connecting with him in the future. Hour number two straight ahead, 1-800-227-5278 for your calls right here on Stand to Reason. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, hour number two here on Sunday. With you every Sunday, in fact, from 3 to 5. Actually, 3 to 4:42 now, until first of the year. See, when the sun goes down here in Southern California earlier, our home station, our flagship station, KBRT, goes off a little earlier, and so we lose a little bit of time. But we'll be back to full charge 2 hours starting in January, I guess. Is that right? Yeah. 1-800-227-5278 in the Orange County area, 714. You can dial up 754-4150 if you want to talk with me about anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion. And I'm putting you on notice here just so you're apprised that in the next few months you're going to hear me talking in a much more aggressive, thoroughgoing way about the issue that is broadly labeled postmodernism, and in particular, its impact on the church in a movement called the Emergent Church. Now, of course, we've talked about this for a long time, and the reason I think it's so important for me to revisit this is, first of all, it is a point of view, a philosophic point of view, that strikes at the very heart of the Christian endeavor. Jesus said, in the Gospel of John is where it's recorded, Jesus before Pilate, "I came to bear witness to the truth." Not a truth, not my truth, not some truth, not somebody's truth, not my socially determined truth, not my linguistically constructed truth, but the truth. And Christianity is built on the idea that some things can be known, and they can be known to be known. And indeed, if that were not the case, then Christians in the past and even today would not have given their life for the claims that they spoke as true. And if we can't say that Christianity is true, if the concept of truth itself is utterly undermined, then there is nothing for us in this religion, ladies and gentlemen, not for me. I'm out of here. If this is just ice cream, even if it's my culturally determined ice cream, even if it's my linguistically constructed ice cream, it's still ice cream. Nonetheless, it's just a flavor. I want out. I've got better things I can do with my life, and so do you. There's only one reason that we're here, and that's because we think we're in touch with reality. And of course, the notion of being in touch with reality is what's under attack. It's not just what we think reality is. That's the old school. That's the modernist school. The atheists thought they were in touch with reality and had one view, and we thought we were, and we had another, and they just thought we were wrong, but they didn't challenge whether one could know reality. And in fact, just a couple of days ago, I was on a panel in San Francisco that's going to be aired, a program that's going to be aired on NPR. Before too long, we'll give you the details of it. The Commonwealth Club, very prestigious public policy club. My understanding is that every single president in the last 70 years, or maybe close to 100 years, have spoken there. And I think the King of Jordan is speaking there this week. Well, I got a chance to participate in a program on fundamentalism in America, group discussion. There were four of us and a moderator. And to my left was David Kong, the president of California Atheists. And one thing I said regarding Dave to the audience is I feel at home with him in a certain sense, because at least we both believe that there's something true about the world. There is a reality out there we can know. We've just come to different conclusions about what that reality actually is. Now, if reality can't be known, we can never say anything truthful about Christianity or about God or about heaven or hell or sin or anything at all. We are all lost in a twilight zone of relativistic nothingness. It turns out to be nihilistic in the end to support this view called postmodernism, which is now seizing the imagination of so many in the church in a movement called the Emergent Church Movement. Now, this is a broad-based movement. Not everybody holds everything here, but it is deeply influenced in its epistemology, that's its understanding about how knowledge works, by postmodernity. And as it turns out, those more leading proponents of this movement, like Brian McLaren, pastor from Washington, D.C., in a number of his writings, critiques Christianity from inside the postmodern worldview instead of critiquing postmodernism from the Bible. And that, of course, is the postmodern turn, the acceptance that knowledge is just a social construct, and so we have to buy that truth and then examine all other truth in light of that truth. Now, this is going to be coming up, and the reason is because everything hangs in the balance here. Issues of sin and salvation and Jesus and God and evangelism and the nature of the church, and indeed the survival of the church in the 21st century. So you're going to hear a lot about it. I want you to understand this, and I want you not to be taken in by it. Part of what we discussed the other day on this panel was this whole issue of in this issue of fundamentalism. Why are more and more people apparently turning to fundamentalist kinds of religions, whether it's Christian fundamentalism or Islamic fundamentalism or Jewish fundamentalism or whatever? That was broadly the topic. And the issue of tolerance came up, and whenever it comes up, I want to work hard to make the point that the new definition of tolerance is a distortion. The old definition of tolerance is virtuous, not the new one. The old one, tolerate people. The new one, tolerate ideas. The old one, human beings had equal value. The new one, all ideas have equal value. So I, as a Christian talking in this venue with a largely liberal audience, in fact, nobody came up to me after the hour and a half discussion time and said, praise the Lord. Nobody said, gee, I'm glad to see you here. I'm glad one of ours was on board. Now, there were a couple of people who identified themselves after some fashion as believers, and maybe they were one of us, I don't know, or like me in that regard, but it wasn't clear. Usually at an event like that, you'll have somebody come up and, you know, pull up beside you, say, you know, all right, good job. I'm glad you're here, you know, speaking for my views, he or she might say. Nothing like that. So it was a largely liberal audience. And when the issue of tolerance comes up in that kind of audience, I want to always make the point, look at, everybody thinks they're right. In fact, everybody in the panel thinks they're right. We have opposing points of view. We think those who differ from us are wrong because we hold the views we hold because they are right. The gentleman immediately to my right, a young man, early 30s, a Jewish man, took exception with that by saying, well, I believe in Judaism for me. Judaism is true for me. Now, I understood the move, and I understood what he understood to be saying, but he was confused, unfortunately. And it was so obvious if you listen carefully to the dialogue, even in that moment. My point wasn't that people who believe in Judaism, all who believe in Judaism, think that all other people should be Jewish. That's clearly not the case. In fact, he made the point, you're not going to have somebody knocking on your door saying, have you ever heard about Moses? He says, we don't walk around asking, what would Moses do? Which got a good chuckle from the laugh, and it was clever. Although I pointed out under my breath that was WWMD, which means it wouldn't have a very long life if you did promote that, because the acronym was suspicious. What would Moses do, WWMD? But he made this point that he didn't want other people to become Jewish, but that wasn't the thing I was addressing. When I said all of us here think we're right, in the points of view that we hold to be true, and he doesn't hold Judaism to be true in that sense, they think they're right. That is, even though he doesn't want everybody to be Jewish, he certainly does believe that the right way to cash out the religious project is through pluralism. All religions are equally valid, and when somebody like Mr. Kokel on this panel says that's not the case, then Mr. Kokel is mistaken. And the person voicing his or her view, contrary to the mistaken view of Mr. Kokel, is correct. That's why they hold the view that they hold. And the irony is, and if you'll catch this if you listen carefully to the broadcast when it comes up. And like I said, we'll post it on our website at str.org. If I have advance notice, I'll mention it to you here. I said everybody in the panel thinks they're right. And the Jewish man said that he only believes that Judaism is true for him. But the way he introduced his idea was with a phrase that was very telling. In fact, this is the way it sounded, Kokel. Everybody on this panel thinks he's right. Jewish man, I disagree. Judaism is true for me, not for others. What was that I disagree business? Wasn't that I disagree, yes, I have a different point of view, and I think that different point of view is what? A what? Correct point of view, right? In other words, when he says, I disagree, now he's going to offer a point of view contrary to mine, a view that he is offering to correct my view, a view that he thinks is right, which is why he said, I disagree. Makes my point perfectly. In fact, and I don't know if the mic caught it, but I said it, and I don't think the audience caught it, but when he said, I disagree, I said, I rest my case. You see, everybody's got a horse in the race. Everybody's got a point of view. Everybody thinks their point of view is true. Now, the exception to that would be as if they're really talking about an ice cream kind of thing. If they are talking just about flavors, they don't think their flavor is the only flavor for somebody else. But the point is that they think that this kind of thing is an ice cream kind of thing, religious belief. That's a point of view called pluralism, and that they think they're right on, contrary to Mr. Kokel, who's one of those nasty exclusivists. In the culture, this is where the game's being played, friends, on this issue. In the church, with regards to the authority of Christianity in the world, same issue. And I was prepared to say, though it didn't move in this direction, with regards to the question of the resurgence in religious fundamentalism, particularly Christian fundamentalism, I was willing to say, yeah, I think there is a kind of activity there in what most people would call fundamentalist circles. That would be people like you and I holding to the fundamentals. But it must be seriously qualified. Because since the 60s, there have been some alarming trends that have taken root and now really dominate the discussion, and that has to do with the nature of the truth claims even of those people who are fundamentals. That is, more and more Christians are making more fundamentalist claims, but they are deeply influenced by a postmodern understanding of pluralism and tolerance, and therefore they have learned it's not permitted to claim that your view is true, so they relativize it or suffer the consequences. In other words, many people will say, yes, Jesus, sin, salvation, God, Christianity. That sounds like fundamentalism. For me, that little phrase, just like the Jewish man offered, relativizing their point of view. Yes, it's all true. It's all the virgin birth, creation, the cross, resurrection. For me. So now the fundamentals are being defended with this qualifier, a qualifier that really is in keeping with an observation that was made by a Harvard graduate who gave the commencement address a number of years ago, in which he said, the liberty of our day is the liberty to believe anything we want on the one condition that we don't believe it's true. Not in the ultimate sense, not in the capital T sense, and this is where the battleground is. And ladies and gentlemen, it's in the church. And I, for one, want to equip you to learn to be able to deal with the single most dangerous threat to what you and I believe. And sorry to say, it's philosophical. That's the nature of the attack. You don't need to know the words. It's coming in from the common man. And it's assaulting and eroding the foundations. And unless we address that in the world and in the church, we will not have a message to speak anymore. It will all be ice cream. 1-800-227-5278. Be taking your calls in just a moment. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's STR.org.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's that time of year again where the cats prevail. You know, here's why I like that music. Because what I picture is a whole string of cats singing a different note and somebody down below them pulling on their tails. See, that's where I go with that. Okay. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. And let's go to the phones. Let's see, where are we at here? What number's Tony on? I can't see the number there. Not that one. What is that one? You got it? It's not number one. It must be number two. Let me just try it. Is this Tony? Hello?
Actually, this is Bob.
Okay, Bob, hold on there. Let me go to Tony. Is this Tony?
That's me.
Tony, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
Okay.
Hey, I really liked your monologue there. You know, I don't believe in God, but I have so much trouble trying to convince people of what you've just said there.
Wait, you do not believe in God?
No, I don't.
So you're an atheist. Okay, go ahead.
And all that stuff, trying to convince people, you know, about your little monologue there, all the facets of what you just say. You know, I live on campus at UCSD for 5 years, and I'm telling you, man, everybody believes that.
UCSD, did you say, down in San Diego?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and I'm glad that you clarified from your own views, because you and I have a lot more in common than some Christians, I think, in the postmodern movement called the Emergent Church, similar to David Kong, who is sitting next to me in this debate, where I said, at least we think the same way about how knowledge works. We've just come to different conclusions about what is true, what are the facts of the matter. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't convince Christians of what you said either.
You know, I read an article by an atheist once in Skeptic Magazine, and the article had to do with how frustrated the atheist was at talking to Christians, because he can't have a good argument anymore because they just appeal to their own feelings and experience instead of to their minds. It's true for them, and so he's just lost any ground of conversation, and it's really tragic from my perspective.
That's true, Greg. Keep the good work on that.
Thank you, Tony. I'll keep up the other good work too.
Great.
On the theism stuff.
Yeah, my question is about the. I was thinking about the morning after pill, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you guys consider the morning after pill, you equate that with abortion, right?
Well, it is an abortifacient, and if abortion is taking the life of an innocent human being, and the RU 486 or any other morning after pill cocktail does that, then it's an abortion. It's the same as if you did a abortion third trimester or something like that. That is, a human being is being destroyed, though at a different stage of that human's development.
Right. I was thinking if a Christian girl got raped and she didn't want to have the baby, didn't want to have an abortion, would you guys be all right with her going in there on, you know, day two and having them take out the egg and then, you know, do an IVF on it, freeze it.
Yeah, I wouldn't have any problem. I mean, a lot of essentially you've got the same kind of thing when you have in vitro fertilization.
Yeah.
And the baby's implanted later, maybe in someone else through embryo adoption. I wouldn't have a problem with that. Why would I? I mean, that would be treating the unborn as the valuable human being it is. So if women, I mean, this is a little bit science fiction-y now, but let's just stipulate that we could do that, that a woman who was pregnant and therefore had a zygote at that stage that had not yet attached, which would be the question with RU486, the morning after pill would not allow the embryo, the zygote there to attach in the uterus and grow through its subsequent stages. That by not allowing that, it still causes the death of that. That would be an abortion. But if you could just take that, and isolate it and then freeze it just like an in vitro fertilization and it can be implanted in someone else, there would be no abortion, obviously. That would be a way of passing this child off to somebody else who would care for it. It's kind of like adoption prenatal, very prenatal.
I mean, that sounds good to me, but I'm wondering if you'd be open to a woman doing the same thing with her newborn if she was just a new mother that just couldn't hack it and just said, I want 10 years to get my life together.
What, freezing the newborn or adopting the newborn?
Freezing the newborn.
No, not freezing the newborn because freezing a newborn would kill the newborn. It doesn't kill the zygote.
Well, and, assuming that it still had a 1/8 chance of making it, you know, because frozen zygotes and IVF have a 1/8 chance of making it.
Not a 1/8. There's about a 30% attrition rate for frozen zygotes, well, at least thawing and surviving the thaw.
Well, once in the tummy, though, then you got another half.
Yeah. Not exactly the tummy, but I know what you mean. Right. Okay. So that's right. So then it's maybe 1/6 then. But the point is, at least you're giving the child a chance at surviving. And
1/6 with a newborn too. I don't know. Would you guys be okay with that?
No, I wouldn't, because the alternative is to give that child away immediately to somebody who can care for that, and it's very easy to hand over a newborn child to parents, and then there'd be 100% success and survival rate. So there's no reason to take the chance at that stage of development.
I see.
That's why I would think of it's different. I mean, it's interesting to kind of play with some of these different concepts, and once the given is that you have a human being that you're obliged to protect as much as possible, then where your responsibilities lie with these different technologies, you know, you have more refined distinctions you need to make, and it's much more difficult to make the decision. But I'm willing to give the benefit of the doubt to anybody who's going to try to save the life of that child, even if that way they save the life has some it has an attrition rate. You know, it's not perfect. Regular pregnancy produces accidental abortions on a regular basis, a 50% ratio anyway.
Right.
So you've got to face that either way.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right, Greg.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Tony. I appreciate that. It's great getting a call from an atheist who says, I agree with you, at least on the concern that I raised, and I'm not surprised at all because that's quite the point I'm making. I have more in common with that caller than I do with a believer who claims to believe in Jesus, but his belief in Jesus is simply a belief in his linguistic construction. Linguistic constructions do not save anyone. All right, on to Steve. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Steve.
Hi, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Thank you very much for being here and doing what you do.
You're welcome.
A lot of people that need what you're doing, and Melinda and everybody else, so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Anyway, I'm a longtime listener, and I have a couple of friends that I've been in discussion with before, and basically they say that a non-believer can do nothing good in the eyes of God. And I said, well, how about if there was a building on fire and they went and rescued children from that building, would they be in sin for doing that? And they said, anything done not from faith is sin.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize for that clicking, if you can hear that.
No, it's not a problem. So Oscar Schindler then not only was a sinner himself, but his saving of Jews was itself a sin on their reckoning. Right?
On my friend's reckoning.
On your friend's reckoning would be a sin. Now, right. What would it have been if they didn't say, if Oskar Schindler could have saved Jews but didn't save Jews?
I don't know. I guess they would just rather him just sit back and chill out.
Well, what they'd have to do is they'd have to say that Oskar Schindler was also not acting in faith in the second case, so therefore his lack of acting would have to be what?
Sin.
Sin, right. So to save, on their view, for a non-believer to save 1,000 people or not to save 1,000 people is exactly morally the same. This to me is, well, it borders on being stupid, but let's just call it foolish, because I think it's a well-intentioned effort to try to make sense of a passage. Is there any place in the Bible where people who are unregenerate are said to have done things that were good things? I bet you can find a number of occasions where that's the case. Now, but the point here, and here's a distinction that, well, one thing I'd ask them is, why do they think this passage applies to non-believers with regard to the behavior that they're doing? I mean, maybe it would be good to get them talking a little bit and defending their understanding of that verse in the application they're making here. So put a little burden of proof on them. But let me make a distinction here. I think it's obvious that the saving of the lives by Oskar Schindler was a good thing. Okay? And you know, if that were the case, think of it. The Bible talks about government. How about this? Paul says, here's a good proof text for you to show that this way of thinking isn't just right. Paul says that the government is there for what? What's the purpose of government? Or maybe Peter. I think it's Paul in Romans. For the what? The punishment of evildoers and the praise of what? Those who do what? Do you know this verse?
You're in Romans 13, right?
Yeah, it could be. It's either Romans 13 or maybe 1 Peter 4, 3. I get them mixed up. But anyway, for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do good or those who do right. In other words, governments are to praise people who do right. Now, according to Paul's analysis or Peter's, whoever it is, there is a way in which non-believers can do right for which the governments are supposed to applaud them. Now, if what people were doing wasn't right, but it was always wrong, then the government should never applaud anybody. It should punish everybody on that view. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm.
So now we've got what this requires of us is to make some distinctions to cash out these differences. We have to find a way of thinking about it, a way of talking about it that captures the distinctions that we're talking about. So here, let me offer a suggestion. And that is there is a difference between a good work and a virtuous act. All right. I want you to hold on for just a minute. Can I finish this or do we have to go to break just now? I finish it. Go to break. Hang on for just a minute, okay, Steve? And then I will come back to you after I read this sign language. Probably the safest thing is to go to break, and then I could take up the extra time to talk to Steve. When I return on Stand to Reason, stay with us. How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise? It's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Stay by the rain, are you listening? And the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. Walking with a wonderland.
Sounds like Dean Martin there.
Gone away.
And since this is Christmas, just a reminder, you've got about 3 weeks to send Stand to Reason a gift. We don't talk about this too much. This is the end of the year, the time when people think about the benefit that's been given to them by other organizations. And I just want you to ask yourself a simple question. And that is, if has Stand to Reason benefited you at all in the last 11 months? I suspect that we have through the radio show, our materials, or whatever. And I just want to remind you that we're a 501c3 corporation that is a religious nonprofit. And we survive because good people like you think we're doing a good job and want us to continue doing a good job with other good people. And then they send us a gift. My challenge is for you to please consider sending us a gift at Stand to Reason this month. I'll give you the address you can send that to in just a moment. Grab a pen. It'll be a great help to us. We've got a pretty big nut to crack here in December. We had a couple of bad months, but we had a couple of good months too. Our months have always been good in terms of productivity, but they haven't always been good in terms of income. And so we've got to make up basically a couple of months worth of income here in December, and we'd like you to consider helping us out. The address at Stand to Reason, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Once again, 1438 East 33rd Street. That's in Signal Hill, California. The zip is 90755. If you want to give a gift for radio, if that's what you listen to most, if that's the way you benefit, that would be great. Or just to help the organization move forward to continue doing what we do well. Next year we want to do a complete overhaul of the website. It's going to be much more effective. It takes a bit of money, and we want to be able to make it better for you too. So please think about helping Stand to Reason this Christmas, especially if you haven't done so yet. 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. You can call us at 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, and make a gift on the phone, or you can go to str.org and give on the website. Back to Steve now, who has been told by other Christians that if no matter what anybody does, it's evil unless they do it of faith. And we talked about some verses that seem to indicate that non-believers can do good because governments are for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right or good. And therefore, if some people do good, we also have this verse that says whatever's not of faith of sin is sin. That's in the book of James, I think, Steve. So how do we make sense of this? And the point that I made, you're still with me, right,
mm-hmm.
Steve? The point that I was making is that since we have verses that seem to teach two contrary things here, how could it be that anything that's not of faith is sin on the one hand, but then non-believers can do good on the other? And it just seems common sense, common moral sense, if you reflect on Oscar Schindler. He did a good thing, let's face it, in saving all those Jews. How do we resolve this? And I think this requires then that we be a little bit more careful about our thinking, that we have to find a way of talking about this that captures this distinction we find in the text. And the distinction that I wanted to offer was a distinction between a virtuous act and a good work. A virtuous act and a good work. The phrase virtuous act, excuse me, for my purposes, pardon me, are focusing in on the individual, where the good work is focusing in on the behavior of the work itself. If I save the life of another person, the saving of the life is a work that is good in itself. All right? But if I do so with bad motive, it does not reflect a virtuous act on my part. I may not be virtuous in doing a good thing, but the good thing still is a good thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think if that's the, unless we have something like that in place, we are not going to be able to, we're going to end up saying foolish things like, it wasn't a good thing, but rather a sinful thing when Oskar Schindler saved the lives of all those Jews. I understand the Christians are trying to capture the meaning of the passage in James, but this is, Christians have this bad habit of trying, of saying things that sound patently stupid instead of, in an application of their verse, instead of thinking, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. There must be more to it here than what we're thinking, and then coming up with a refinement that might rectify the circumstances, and that's what I was just offering there. Does that make sense?
Yes. Now, earlier in the conversation, you said that there would be actually no difference from saving the people from the burning building or having the obligation to do so and not doing it.
On their view, they are left with saying there is no moral difference between saving the Jews and not saving them for an Oskar Schindler. Since he is not a believer, he can't do anything of faith, therefore everything he does is equally wrong, and it wouldn't have mattered whether he did that or not. Morally speaking, that's what their view leads to. This is a taking the roof off tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Showing where it leads. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. See, what I'd like your friends to be able to do is to confront that fact and say, yep, that's where my view leads, and that ain't right. Something's amiss here. Let's retrace and see if we can find out a way to make a distinction that will help fix this problem. And I think distinguishing between the good work and the virtuous act is a fair way to do it. So we could say, nothing that a person is going to do, apart from faith in Christ, is going to be a virtuous act that is meritorious, that will merit some kind of reward by God. But it still can, the act itself still can be a good thing to do.
Right. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. They're coming from the idea that your nature is tainted in such a way that you cannot do anything good.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with that you can't do anything good. And I think that's a misunderstanding of the concept of total depravity. I'm going to have to run. We just got a minute or two to go, Steve. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Bob, finishing out the show. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's see. I'm having a discussion with a friend of mine, and the issue was in terms of the justification from the Christian's perspective on capital punishment.
Right.
And I indicated, well, there definitely is a case to be made where the issue of those who committed murder in the Old Testament were executed,
mm-hmm.
and certainly the Ten Commandments. Now, one of the points he made is, but it says in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. And I said, well, I believe the correct interpretation is thou shalt not murder.
Actually, it's not an interpretation. It's a translation. That's different. It's not an interpretive element. You're right. It's just a different word. It's thou shalt not murder, and it couldn't possibly mean kill anyway, since killing was part of the provision of the law itself in capital crimes.
Right, and then he goes on to say, okay, now since you're being selective on the laws of the Old Testament that you're going to accept and the ones that you don't, case in point, the stoning of children who are, you know, extremely disobedient to their children.
Okay. Yeah,
wives.
Let me jump in because we're very short on time to give you an answer here. Our case, my case would be not that every single law in the Bible must be punished in the same way that the Decalogue or the larger the Torah recommended it be or commanded that it be punished, but that capital punishment is a legitimate form of punishment to be used today, because not only do we have it in the Torah, but we also have it earlier in Genesis 9:6, and you probably are familiar with this passage.
Right.
So even before the law, the idea of shedding man's blood requires that your blood also be shed, because the image of God created man. We see this principle then even before the law is given. So we know that there is a legitimacy to capital punishment in general, okay? And then we saw it applied in a number of different circumstances in the Jewish law. I would not argue that the law must be transported wholesale from the way that the Jews had the law underneath the theocracy to Gentiles not under a theocracy. That's not my argument. My argument is that there is a principle in that law, as in general jurisprudence of lex talionis, the law of the claw, that is, that it's generally cited eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, basically. But the idea is that the punishment should fit the crime. And since we have examples of this even before the law, I think we could execute people for capital crimes in this country and be totally consistent with the Bible. Are you picking up on this refined distinction I'm making between that and the law?
Yes, and I think I've read some of your works on that, or some paper on that, or something like that.
If you go to our website and at str.org and you type in capital punishment, you'll have an outline there that will help you pursue this conversation with your friends. Thanks for the call, Bob, and that's the end of the show, folks, for this week. We've got a week ahead of us to be good ambassadors for Christ. I encourage you to please be thinking about that everywhere you go. Please remember, stand to reason this holiday season. It's the end of the year for us, and we'd appreciate a gift from you if we have helped you in any way this last year. That's how we survive at STR. Remember, a good ambassador, an accurately informed mind, knowledge, an artful method, wisdom, and an attractive manner, character. I'm Greg Kokel for STR. You give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye now.